Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Guess who I'm talking to? I'm speaking to Ed from Friendly Fires. We have a lovely chat, and you're in for a real treat for this. Ed's wonderful, and we speak about so many good records. We get to speak about a bit of skateboarding, which is always a real joy, and we get to discuss our mutual love of, now that's what I call music compilations. Yeah, that's right, I said that. And there's even a gap in the middle where I rush off to go and find my copy of Now That's What I Call Music 1. But you're going to hear all of that and some incredible choices from Ed very soon. Obviously, we're talking about this because the first record's 15 years old. If that don't make you feel old, I don't know what will. But yeah, I mean, what a record as well. And yeah, we chat, obviously, about everything that's going to be coming your way soon from Friendly Fires towards the end of this chat. And before we get on with it, a few thank yous. I want to thank the Distraction Pieces podcast, which is headed up by the podfather himself, Mr. Scroobius Pip. I'd like to thank the team at the Blue Murder Club podcast for producing this pod. And always, the biggest thanks and love go to you lot for continuing to support this podcast. And we're 500 episodes in. And it's just growing and growing, and that's because of you lovely lot continuing to support and share and retweet and do all those things you're doing. So keep doing what you're doing, and yeah, huge love. Thank you. If you'd like to support the podcast in another way and get even more content, then you can become a Patreon. I put out two episodes for free each week on all the usual platforms. So that's quite a bit for a podcaster to stick out two interviews a week. But if you like to watch them episodes or you want to get access to all the radio shows, a huge back catalogue of other stuff that's never come out to the public, then head over to Patreon, patreon.com/ Off the Beat and Track. And it's a dollar, so it works at about 70-odd pence a month, and that gives you access to all of that. And it also gives you access to our monthly live show, and that's done over Zoom, and it's lovely. It's a really cool little hangout. We've got a smashing gang of people that turn up to it, and we just pick a little question from the podcast, and we all talk about the records that had that kind of impact on our lives. It's not – everyone's not turning up trying to be super cool – B-side indie wanker. Everybody's being very honest with their record choices. It's not a judgy thing. It's just a really lovely little nerdy hangout where you can just chat about records with some really adorable people. You're more than welcome just to turn up and have your camera off and your mic off and just listen in, or you can get as involved as you would like. And again, that is all part of what you get for your Patreon subscription, which is about 70p a month. You can find out about that and everything else to do with the podcast at the website as well, which is offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. And also, if this is your first time listening to the pod, hello. You've started with a great episode. You're in for a real treat for this one. When you get to the end of today's chat with Ed, why not go and explore the back catalogue? Because I've been really lucky. I've had some wonderful chats with kind of amazing producers like Butch Vig and Norman Cook. And then, you know, I've also been lucky to speak to some sort of rock giants like The Foos and Tommy Lee and Motley Crue. And if you like your UK indie stuff, then I've been super lucky there. You know, you can hear me talking to the likes of Foles, the Kaiser Chiefs, the Kooks. And if you kind of want to go overseas, I've been lucky enough to sort of speak to the Killers. Oh, they're all there. There's hundreds of them, hundreds of episodes. Go and get stuck in. When you finish this episode, go and have a good old rummage in the archives, and I promise you, you will find something that you will enjoy listening to. Right, let's get on with it. Please enjoy today's episode of Off the Beaten Track podcast with the delightful Ed from Friendly Fires.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Okay, we are recording. Ed, how are you today?
I'm doing good. Thanks so much, Stu, for having me on.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure, mate. Where are you today? It looks very studio-based.
I'm in my home studio, just north of Hitchin. Kind of getting on with writing music.
Wonderful. And what I did. Wonderful. I mean, it seems weird to kind of look back to something that I guess, you know, would probably be a distant memory for that most people wish it would be anyway. But tell me a little bit about lockdown and how you found that creatively.
Creatively, it started out okay, and then it dwindled. Okay. If you know what I mean. I think I had that initial sort of burst of, well, hey, I can get on and write stuff. I've got all this time. But then I don't know what stopped it, to be honest. Maybe it was just the monotony of having nothing to do but be at home.
Yeah.
And also like bouncing off other people. It's one thing kind of, you know, sending emails to each other or exchanging music via email, but like having someone in the room with you is entirely different. And that's something that I really cherish. Like as far as, you know, writing music, you know, we still try and do that as much as we can, basically.
Did you feel a sort of almost like a knee-jerk reaction to, right, okay, so all of a sudden there's none of the pressures that present themselves daily to a musician. I have the time to create more, so I should max that. Just from speaking to other musicians, they felt that kind of, well, I've got the time, so I've got to maximize it. And you can't necessarily force these things, right?
Yeah, 100%. But I think I find it hard enough writing music as it is, to be honest with you. It's like, you know, I still have that pressure on my shoulders, regardless of whether, you know, there's I have more free time. And, you know, to be honest with you, I think I work kind of better when I have pressure on my shoulders.
Yeah.
If there's like a deadline, it's like, okay, we got to get cracking. Like I found with our last record, we put out the single before we'd finished the album. And, you know, it's like, okay, we're making a statement. This is happening. There's no turning back now. So it's like, you know, all cylinders are firing, if you know what I mean. Whereas if everything's just open, it's like, oh, maybe I'll mess around with this synth for like 2 weeks. Or,
yeah,
you know,
you
can get lost in the stuff that just isn't important, I guess. And yeah. So yeah, to be honest with you, I'm writing way more now than I was in lockdown.
Oh, that's so good. Let's start your playlist. I want you to tell me, please, Ed, for track one, the song that you regard as having the greatest ever intro, please.
I had a big think about this, and I was like, well, there's so many amazing tunes with awesome intros or intros that almost define genres. I was like, okay, Goldie, Inner City Life. I love that really expansive intro. Korn, Blind. It's like the sound of new metal.
Why has no one ever chose that? I've done 500 really? Of these and no one's ever chose Blind by Korn. And it basically was most people's introduction to new metal, right?
It literally starts with, are you ready? I mean, that's like the ultimate intro to anything. But yeah, so that, and I was like, you know, I was like, oh, Frankie Knuckles and Jamie Principle, the kind of the arpeggiator sound, which is kind of also like a cool intro where it's like more like a siren rather than something that's long or expansive. Your Love. But then I was like, well, what about in my life? What was the kind of my introduction to music? And it's a boring answer, but I was just like, it's got to be Nirvana Smells Like Teen Spirit, because just I remember the time when I heard it. I remember exactly where I was, who I was with, and it was like a defining point for me in terms of like, I was like, okay, I'm into this music thing. This is what I'm into. And I remember the year, I was you know, since, you know, you gave me all these questions, I was like trying to chronologically remember all this stuff in my head. And I was like, okay, it was either 92 or 93. I was 8 or 9. I was with my brother. We were in Games Workshop in Luton. We were big into, like, you know, nerdy painting model stuff. And one of the guys that worked there had long hair.
Of course he did. Of course he did.
Yeah, I think he was more of a metaler than a grunge guy. But either way, he put on that track, and everyone started moshing in Games Workshop. It was the weirdest, funniest thing I've ever seen. And I was just like, I went up to him and was like, what is this? And he told me what it was. And I was like, from that moment, I was like, I'm not into, like, painting models anymore, or, you know, doing that stuff. Like, music is what I'm about.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, asking my mom to buy me it because I was too embarrassed because it had, like, a naked baby on the front cover, you know? And it was just, yeah. And weirdly enough, my brother, who I was with at the time, he actually designs models for Games Workshop now. So he kind of stayed on that path. And then I kind of moved into the kind of the music thing. And so I have, like, that track to, like, thank for just, I think, just the energy of it, you know? The production is also something that is just so, it's just so immediate. And also kind of, you can grasp it if you're young. I think when you're young, things that sound really well produced tend to be easier to approach.
I was lucky enough to have Butch Vig on the podcast, and he bizarrely didn't choose this for intro, and I had to question that. And and he was saying that, you know, that the first review he read of it, somebody described it that when Dave Grohl's drums kick in that intro, it felt like the house had just collapsed on top of them, and it is such a barrage of noise. And but on the production thing as well, from what I gather, if you know what you read and what you hear, is Kurt wasn't actually a fan of that kind of Butch Vig production, was he? He was more the Steve Albini kind of,
yeah, like, he wants a punk and wants a raw. But the thing that's amazing about that intro is that whenever you hear, like, a school band covering it and the drum fill comes in, it's like, it just sounds pitiful. And it's something to do with the way, you know, the way that it was recorded. I think, I don't know if they tracked the drums with early sort of tracking using samples, but it just sounds, as you said, it sounds freaking huge.
Yeah.
And and I just remember hearing that fill kick in, and it was like, okay, my life's changed from this point.
And the thing is as well, if we talk about Nevermind as an album as well, it gets thrown into, you know, terminology like grunge and things like that. It's one of the most as an indie DJ in my club, I've been playing that record for 30 years, right? And maybe apart from Something in the Way, I can play any track from that album and it will go off still to this day with the next generation, because I think it's a perfect pop record. I think every track on Nevermind is pure pop. It's just loads of, obviously, quite loud. But the hooks and the choruses are just absolute pop gems.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of why grunge is different to, like, punk and hardcore. I mean, I don't listen to that much Nirvana now, but to me, that record you're right, it's a pop record. It's great songwriting. It's kind of like more like good rock music as well, which is, you know, different from maybe what he was influenced by, which was just more about kind of trashy energy, whatever. So it's it's, you know, it's just textbook great songwriting. I mean, listening to it now, the one I really like is Territorial Pissings, just because it's like the hardcore track, or the punk track off the album.
Pure chaos.
Yeah, and the vocals are just, you know, awesome. At the end, it's like, you can tell that he's feeling it.
Yeah.
It's not forced.
In regards to yourself as a musician and songwriter, the way that people are consuming their music now and getting their music is probably different now to how it was when Friendly Fire started as a band. We're now seeing things like TikTok being used to market music, and I, you know, there's songs that I play that my children are singing, I'm like, how the hell do you know that? And they're like, oh, it's on TikTok. And obviously the desire to be on certain Spotify playlists, which has maybe replaced that desire to be on whatever radio station it was, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Tell me, has any of these kind of... Because one of the things that with that kind of TikTok generation and the Spotify playlists, it feels that there's a lot of interest in, you've got to hook them quickly. Mm. And I know that maybe that's more with sort of mainstream pop, you know, which has almost become a sort of science in itself of creating this perfect 2-minute thing that is an earworm. And how much of any of the stuff that I've just mentioned has filtered through into your creative process, if at all?
I think not really that much. I think we naturally try and keep our music pretty immediate, but that has nothing to do with, I think, trying to be, you know, trying to fit into some kind of, or just to make it more marketable.
Sure.
Am I a fan of it? No. it's definitely not what I'm into. I guess even like playlists feel really sort of sterile to me, you know, compared, like, you know, I grew up listening to compilations, and I mean, I'm going to, you know, some of the music that I discovered through compilations that we're going to be listening to later. And so it's like, you know, I appreciate, you know, things, the idea of like a playlist, but I think it's just the fact that it's this constant stream that things just get lost, and it's, and you're also not living with it, you know. I don't know. I don't want to whine. I don't want to be one of those whiners, because it is what it is. But
it's a safe space to whine, Ed. It's all right.
But yeah, you know, it's, you know, just, I guess it is what it is. I think for us, yeah, we're kind of lucky in the sense that we've always wanted to just write music that grabs you straight away. And you know, if we were, say, like a Foles band or whatever, it might be a bit different, where you're like, you know, some of their biggest tunes have long intros. Yeah. So in that respect, it's probably might be a bit more of an issue. But for us, it's like we'd like to like kick in the drums and all the rhythm like straight away and just get it going, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. Tell me about the first song you remember hearing, please, Ed, that had an emotional impact on you.
So, yeah, I guess, there are so many. There's music that your parents play you that's, you know, I have like really fond memories of dancing with my dad to Stick Together by Bryan Ferry. You know, just my growing up listening to Michael Jackson, all of that stuff. But I think in terms of like a specific emotion that I feel like I've been trying to like capture in our music, which is, you know, like that kind of sense of like euphoria or that epicness, the kind of moment that makes you want to like hug your friends and just, you know, that, like, I guess you hear in a lot of like rave and house and whatever, but I was too young to be into that music. So for me, it was Oasis Slide Away, just because it has, I guess it's like kind of shoegazy. I don't know. Do you know what I mean? It has those lush melodies that are just, that aren't on every Oasis tune. I was like, the end of like Live Forever has that same kind of feel, which is, I don't know how to describe it, just melodies that feel really kind of like emo almost. Do you know what I mean?
That Slide Away, bizarrely, is my favorite Oasis track as well. And I do think that's the closest they get to shoegaze. I do think it's got that feel to it. And yeah, I there's something about when that album come out, you know, I was sort of 18, and I just caught it at the right time, and it was super exciting. But for me, being a shoegaze fan, it was always Slide Away that I gravitated to straight away. It was like, yeah, this is the one that just feels, it's got, I don't know, it's got something different to it that the rest of that record hasn't got.
Yeah, I think it didn't have the kind of Beatles-y melodies that I just found a bit boring to my ears. I wanted like, yeah, that kind of dreaminess. And, you know, it's like, I guess that was the kind of entry point for me to like Creation Records. And then you hear My Bloody Valentine, and you hear like Swerve Driver, and you hear all of that stuff. And then you're like, oh, that's the stuff that I'm really into.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't have got there had it not been for, you know, that track. And also like Oasis at Nebworth was my first gig. So that was kind of, yeah. So I was like, yeah, I was 12. The only reason I went was because I lived next to the site of where it was. Right. And they gave my family like 12 free tickets. So I was like the popular kid for a weekend. And it was really intense. Yeah, really intense experience. Like just loads of pissed up lads. And you know, I couldn't get close to the stage. So all the kind of the screen visuals were totally out of sync with the music.
Yeah.
So it's just like, I don't know. It was weird. I kind of felt like maybe these aren't like my people. This isn't my crowd. I kind of knew from that early age, and I knew that I wanted to, like, it sounds really pretentious or like snooty, but I wanted to like dig deeper and, you know, find something that maybe related to me a bit more, I guess.
I don't think that's snooty. I think that's just a realization, isn't it?
Yeah. But I don't want to be like, oh, I'm better than lad culture or whatever. But it was just, I guess it was just like something I just didn't gel with that vibe. I think I was a bit like a more shy person. And like, yeah. I guess, you know, I mean, I was 12, but yeah. I knew that wasn't going to, and maybe being like a middle-class kid as well, I felt like it wasn't, I couldn't quite relate to it in the way that, I guess, you know, if you're a working-class lad and you hear Oasis, it's, you know, I can totally get why that music is for you. Do you know what I mean?
I did hear an interesting thing that Noel Gallagher said recently about Nebworth and why it's revered so much, and, you know, and he said the thing that I think made it so special was the fact that it was pre-mobile phone, and so that connection, there was nothing interfering. Everyone was like there. It was us, you know, and the crowd, and there was no one texting, there was no one ringing their friends, there was no one filming it. And I thought, I'd never considered that. And like, and you just think, how, you know, it's a given now when you're at shows that you presume that somebody at some point is going to stand in front of you with, you know, with their phone, you know, up above their head, filming something that you should be, I guess, maybe more directly engaged with. But, you know, it's horses for courses. What's your stance on that?
I mean, you can't control what people want to do, really.
Sure.
You can't control how the audience are going to react. You know, like that recent Royal Blood thing. It's just really embarrassing. Like, I mean, I'm watching it from the sidelines being like, oh, God. You know, it's just like, you just got to get up there and do your thing. And whether, you know, whether you're playing to tons of people or barely anyone, or whether they're enjoying it or not enjoying it, you play like you play. And maybe that ethos for me comes from getting into like punk and hardcore at a young age,
where
you're playing to like five people and you still got, you know, you've traveled 5 hours or whatever just to like play the show. So you may as well put the effort in. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Whereas, you know, I think, yeah, sort of, you know, people are going to react how they react. Yeah. So just get on with it.
Absolutely. You touched on dancing around the front room, to Brian Ferry and stuff, in your dad's record collection. Was growing up, was home musical?
Kind of, not really. I think, you know, yeah, like my dad would have like the standards, I guess. He had like Fleetwood Mac, Roxy Music, yeah, Phil Collins. You know, the kind of what I would consider just the standard records to have. Yeah,
the big hitters of the day, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think, but apart from that, it wasn't, you know, yeah, we weren't, I think maybe that memory stuck out of dancing with my dad to that track because we didn't listen to that much music maybe growing up. And when we did put that on, I was like, oh, wow, we're actually having a good time here. Great. Let's do this more often. Do you know what I mean?
Where was home?
So home, St. Albans. Yeah, growing up. So yeah, pretty much been in this part of neck of the woods.
Yeah.
Forever. You know, I lived in London for a bit, but I guess, yeah, I kind of had the idea of living in London. Hey, we're going to be meeting loads of like-minded people and we're going to be writing music all the time. And it's just, you know, it just wasn't a reality for me, I guess. So it's like being back out here, being in nature, I can really like focus on the important stuff, like taking the dog for a walk, getting in the studio and then just getting on with it, really, I guess.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's really interesting what you just said then, and that's the whole reason why this podcast is called Off the Beat and Track. Just at the end of me road is a mate of mine who's a former musician called Scroobius Pip, and I used to have so many conversations with Pip, and we'd be out and about, and people would be like, you live in Essex? Like, what? You don't live in London? And he's like, No, it's only 25 minutes on the train. Yeah, but why don't you live in London? And he's like, well, I quite like living in Essex. It was just that. But also, when you sort of reach further afield than maybe sort of St. Albans and Essex and sort of peripheries of London, you know, there is that desire for artists that live maybe further north or further down to move to London, because that's where you get your shot. And, you know, and I find it really interesting, you know, how people have different sort of takes on that. Did you move to London after the band were established?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, to be honest, I've kind of always felt like as a band, we were kind of, that sounds really lame, but outsiders in the sense of we didn't really like neatly fit into like any genre. I think we were kind of, okay, we're broadly indie, but we're kind of like pretty poppy. We're kind of really influenced by like house and disco. You know, we started out playing actual club nights. And then, you know, we kind of, I never felt like we were really a band that could just move to say London and then be around all the indie bands and we'd all be like a cool collective together. It never felt like that for us. And we've always recorded most of our music ourselves, so it's like we've always been kind of insular in that sense. We've never needed to be near like a posh studio or anything. So I guess maybe in my mind I just had this, you know, romantic idea that we would be part of some kind of collective, and which, you know, I mean, I wish that was the case. I always get jealous when I see bands that are like, their mate is an amazing artist and they have like, you know, they just all of these things perfectly fit together. Yeah. Whereas, you know, we're from St. Albans. Like finding people that were just into the same stuff as us was hard enough.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Just finding people that are into the same music, let alone kind of being in a collective where, you know, there was, you know, so I kind of, in that sense, I've kind of felt like we were outsiders, you know.
But all them people that weren't outsiders, they all had their High Fidelity moment in a really cool record shop. You had yours in Games Workshop. Like, there's the difference. It started early, I think.
Well, weirdly enough, like, I mean, our live bass player, I met in HMV in St. Albans. He worked at HMV, and I bought a Boards of Canada CD, and I went up, and we just started chatting about Boards of Canada. I was working at O'Neill's pub. He'd finished work and came, and, you know, I served him a beer, and then we just started chatting. And then from there, he's been our live bass player since we were 18 years old. Yeah. So record shops as well, you know.
Absolutely. Shout out HMV. The aforementioned Scroobius Pip, that was where he met Dan Lesac. They both worked in HMV in Lakeside.
Amazing. Yeah.
Right. I'm going to ask you now to tell me the song that reminds you of your time at school, please, Ed.
So, I was thinking about this. I think, Ed, Jack and I, we've always been like pretty exploratory and like, I mean, we're always kind of competitive almost in a way where we wanted to like find something cool and then play it to our mates and be like, have you heard this? Have you heard that? And I guess, trying to search for like our identity and find something that feels kind of unique to us. And I think we were kind of, you know, we went through your obvious like new metal phase and went through like a kind of pop punk phase. And I think we were sort of trying to search for something a little deeper. And then Ed and I went over to visit one of our friends in just outside Washington, D.C. This was in 1999. I remember it because we spent 2000 at a really lame house party when no one was drinking. But anyway, yeah. So the good thing about that trip was that we went to a record shop called Smash Records in Georgetown. And it was like entering kind of like an Aladdin's cave for us. You know, we were like 16 years old and it was just like, you know, Discord Records, Black Flag, just all this kind of cool stuff. Cool US punk and hardcore that was kind of harder to find. You know, they had like a punk and hardcore section in Tower Records in Piccadilly. And maybe there was a punk hardcore shop that we just didn't know about that we were too young. But for us, it was just like, wow, there's so much cool music here. And one of those bands was on Discord Records, you know, Fugazi, Minor Threat, and they were called Q and Not You. And that whole record just had, I guess it was coming out of like an art punk scene, but it had like that kind of dance element to it that felt super fresh for us. It was like, okay, girls can dance to this. This isn't like macho bro music.
Yeah.
And it felt like the almost like the proto sound of what would become like DFA Records and, you know, the stuff later, you know, had that kind of dancey punk attitude like a couple of years before.
Sure. I'd never heard of them. And when you sent the list over, I went and had a listen. And the first thing that I could equate it to was kind of the really early At the Drive-In stuff before One Arm Scissor and stuff like that. It was more along that kind. That was what I kind of got from it. I don't know if you can sort of hear that in it.
Yeah. I guess it was where hardcore was becoming a bit more arty and less macho.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah.
And like those kind of dueling guitars that just really like capture your attention, like really angular sounding stuff. And but I guess with the Q and Not You stuff, they had like a disco beats on the album. They had like an open hi-hat, like those sort of moments that are like, wow, this is kind of danceable and interesting.
Yeah.
And I think that really was like a kind of for us, like a real early influence, definitely on the first record. And then, you know, there are other bands that came out of that scene, especially in 2000, like the first Chick 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 record, but we're going to talk about in a bit, where it was like, wow, this is what we're about.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that sort of seemed to be the thing that we really wanted to focus on.
I just want to sort of touch on school a little bit. Was that something that you enjoyed, school?
Not really. I didn't dislike it or like it. I think we were really fortunate that we were kind of able to like find our clique pretty early on. Like in the first year, we were like, you know, maybe someone was wearing a Deftones t-shirt or something.
Yeah.
Like Jack was sort of into the kind of more kind of cooler end of stuff. Like he was really into Mogwai and Super Furries but he was the drummer in school. So I was like, okay, I'm going to become friends with you because we've got to write music today. We have like a desire to write music.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we just used to hang out in the music room and just listen to records. We had a really cool music teacher that was, that would just let us bunk off going to assembly and we just hang out there. And, you know, that was kind of, I think that was like the most important thing about school really for us.
Did you know what you wanted to be?
No, probably not. I knew that I wanted to do, I knew that I really loved music and I wanted to do music, but it definitely didn't seem like something that I'd want to admit to my parents or my teachers. Do you know what I mean? I think they would have just, especially going to like a, you know, like a private school, you know, they want you to do something proper with your life, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, you did in the end, didn't you, right?
Well, yeah, but I still think, you know, my parents were like, I'll believe this is going somewhere when you start making some money out of it, I guess, rather than it just being, oh, the song gets played on the radio or whatever. It was like, I think they were like, oh, that's cool, congratulations, but are you going to be able to turn this into something?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I guess that's just maybe just coming from a, you know, like a background where, yeah, my parents, like, they're kind of like from a working class background, very hardworking, and everything is about, you know, a bit more money focused, I guess. Sure. Whereas, you know, I'm kind of, yeah, all of the kind of heroes that I'm into, I guess it's like it's about creating, you know, I sound really pretentious, but about creating good art and being able to like exist and do it.
That's
rather
not
than
pretentious. Not
well, you know, just being able to like, you know, like just being able to exist and get by, but do what you love is definitely,
yeah.
Now that's the thing that I'm striving for, rather than you know, having loads of cool shit or whatever. I don't know.
You can get by doing what makes you happy. You're winning 100%.
Yeah, definitely.
Tell me the first song you remember buying from a record store, please, Ed.
Okay, so yeah, we're kind of going back in time a little bit, and yeah, going back to compilations and how, yeah, it's just like the earliest way for me to like discover music, apart from the radio, of course. But yeah, so I think it was buying Now That's What I Call Music compilations. Did you ever buy those, or you're older than me, so you're probably like, that's lame. I'm never gonna
wait there 2 seconds. Keep this in my little recording room because this is the first record I ever owned.
Oh my goodness me. And amazing.
It's the first ever Now compilation.
Yes. And I love it. Sorry for saying, you know. That's so cool.
But yeah, it absolutely changed my life. It was like, oh, all of a sudden, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm of an age where most of them records that you said you was dancing to your dad to happened to be on the first record I bought. So I'm definitely a lot older. But yeah, I think sometimes they're sort of sneered upon a little bit, the Now compilations. And I can kind of understand why to a certain degree. But I also think you mentioned that Oasis were like a gateway for Swerve Driver and things like that. I think that the Now compilations are a gateway to a multitude of different artists.
100%. 100%. And I think, you know, it's... And also you get to live with the tracks, and there might be certain things on there where you start to appreciate the artistry a bit more.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, it might be like a Eurythmics song on there or wherever, where it's like, if you're young, you're like, oh, I don't like electro-y sounding music. And then you start to like, you know, you just listen to it more because it's on a cassette or whatever. You have to listen to it.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, actually, this track's really growing on me or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, for me, it was Now 29. I'm trying to think what else was on there. It was like Wet, 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 or, you know, whatever. It was like classic 90s, textbook 90s. 1994, and so I heard, yeah, Weezer, Buddy Holly, and I was like, I need to get this track. But yeah, you know, it was just like super, I don't know, what would you say, kind of like catchy, like 50s sounding punk or whatever. I don't know. Yeah, it was just appealed to me, I guess. It had that kind of saccharine, sugary energy, but like kind of gnarly sounding guitars.
Yeah.
And so yeah, I went to Classical Rock in Harpenden, which is a record shop that I bought my first Swerve Driver record from as well. But I wanted to buy Buddy Holly, but they had Say It Ain't So. That was the only one they had. And so I just took that home and I was like, this is really cool. This song is like just as good as Buddy Holly.
Yeah, that's a happy accident. It's a cracker, Say It Ain't So, isn't it?
Yeah, I know, yeah. And like it's also kind of the record that my dad likes the most as well. So we kind of, I don't know why my dad really loves that first Weezer album. It's just like his favorite record. Every time I get in a car with him, he's just like always got it on or has it somewhere like stashed away. And I think it was just this, you know, once again, like a real gateway album for me getting into like, you know, probably from there I would have got into like Green Day or something, And, yeah, so big ups. Now that's what I call music compilation. So, because I wouldn't have heard that tune otherwise.
Sure. Tell me about, you know, a young Ed.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hearing, you know, that first Weezer record, which is, you know, sort of soaked in pop melodies and that, and then what did you make of it when you were Pinkerton?
I think initially I didn't get it.
Yeah,
I was like, I just didn't think the songs were as good.
Yeah.
Now I can appreciate it a lot more.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I haven't really listened to it properly in a while, but I listened to it about half a year ago, just randomly out of the blue, which is not, I just wouldn't really listen to it like Weezer now, but I was just like, what? Like, for some reason it came to my head and I was like, this is way better than I remember it being.
Yeah. Totally agree. What's your relationship like with the record shop now? I mean, I often speak to artists that, you know, they're out on tour, they go to a new town, they will hunt out the, you know, the local record store and get lost in there for half an hour. Are you that kind of person?
Yeah, 100%. I'll like, if we go on holiday, I'll drag my missus to like every record shop, or I'll say, you know, go and get a coffee because I'm going to like see what I can find.
Yeah.
I think I've always been like a real nerd. Like some of my closest friends work in record shops. Like at my birthday the other day, Nick from Fonica came down. And, you know, like, I think it's so important when you meet people, like it's so important that there are people that work at record shops that have the right attitude, that is inclusive, and that have this desire to kind of, to share their knowledge with you.
Yeah.
Because, you know, everyone knows what it's like to go into a record shop when there's just some miserable old geezer that just doesn't, you know, that's just frowning at you.
Yeah.
But it's amazing when you go somewhere and you know, and someone's really welcoming, and they, you know, they ask you, hey, what are you into? Hey, check this out. And they give you like five records or whatever. And I've been really fortunate that I've met those people along the way. So yeah, Nick from Fonica, when I was at university in Nottingham, one of my first friends I made was Chris, who works at Reckless in Soho now. And he was just one of the people that would be like, hey, man, how you doing? Check this out. And then I'd see him at a show later that week, and he'd be like, hey, come and hang out. So it's, you know, the record shop is really important for me. It's how I discover music still.
Yeah. Let's go clubbing. Track 5, the song that soundtracked your years clubbing, please, Ed.
I guess most of the clubbing I would have done would have been in that kind of, you know, university period, I guess.
Where was uni? And
so uni for me was Nottingham Trent, and, you know, it was a good time to be in Nottingham. It was Stealth, Rescue Rooms. It was that real kind of crossover point between house and techno and minimal and your classic indie disco.
Yeah.
And I guess Stealth and Rescue Rooms, I mean, Stealth was quite literally above Rescue Rooms, so you were able to like switch between the two. And yeah, they've kind of, you know, as you know, there was like DFA Records was really big at the time. Their banger stuff was really big at the time. And for me, it was that first Chick, or the second Chick 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 record, but especially that track, Me and Giuliani, just because it kind of, for me, it just felt like it understood dance music a little bit better. It was like really acidy, really like sounded great on pills. You know, it was just like a real, it reminds me of like discovering that whole side of listening to music as well, which, you know, which is, it's not something I do that often now.
Yeah.
At the time, you know, kind of taking pills and acid and then listening to certain music was really like revelatory and probably really like inspiring for writing music as well. Maybe not, you know, just in terms of the feelings that you get when you're listening to music in that state. And yeah, I think that track just, it sort of morphs through all these kind of different phases, and it's kind of, yes, it's a total trip, but super danceable, works in a kind of club environment, and it also works in a kind of more of an indie kind of environment. Yeah. So I think that's, yeah, to me, that's like the gold standard for that sound. And it's definitely what, you know, what we kind of try and keep it in our minds when we're writing our stuff.
It was a really like huge crossover moment, wasn't it? Like, I think, you know, all of the, you know, you mentioned Ed Banger and Kitsune as well. Like all of them labels were, you know, within months remixing the biggest indie bands. And then all of a sudden them indie bands had, you know, way more danceable tracks for the clubs and things like that. It was obviously a huge melting pot. But I want to sort of touch on something that you said about that track. And you said, oh, you know, there's acidy bits in it. Like, was you already aware of what had happened 20 years previously musically, you know, with Acid Ass and that sort of era of electronic music? Or was it discovering them bands around that point that sort of pushed you to go back and explore, you know, the kind of roots of that?
Oh, it was definitely, yeah, working our way back. I think our introduction into like dance floor, well, house music or techno was really when Minimal House was massive. So it was Ricardo Villalobos. It was like Ghostly Records, all of that stuff. And so, yeah, I had to work my way back, like with most things, you know, and I had to, you know, discover just like early Detroit music. And then listening to kind of, you know, Frankie Knuckles and Jamie Principle, Your Love, which we actually covered on our first ever single. It was like, okay, this, I'm like understanding the lineage of where this all kind of comes from. Yeah. And I think that's really important. Yeah. I think, you know, it's important to, if you're going to be inspired by something, just learn about the history of it rather than just hearing a cool track and then taking something from it and using it. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's an entirely different like conversation, but yeah, it was a real kind of period of like discovery and just, you know, kind of our introduction to like, yeah, that house and techno stuff and working our way back, but also seeing bands kind of incorporating it into their sound.
Yeah. I'm going to take you home for track 6 and ask you to tell me a favorite song from an artist from your home county, please, Ed.
So, yeah, I was thinking about this. I listened to the interview you did with Enter Shikari, and I was
with Rao or with
the drummer, I think.
The drummer, right? Yeah,
yeah, and it was. That's one thing. There's, you know, definitely like a real hardcore scene within kind of Watford and St Albans, and you know, there's then obviously I think he mentioned the Zombies, which were kind of, I guess, you know, iconic St Albans band. But there's also like an amazing like electronic scene from St Albans. So there's like Fotek, this legendary drummer, bass producer.
Was Fotek from St Albans?
Yeah, it's from St Albans. Yeah. Yeah, so Fotek's St Albans, Source Direct. Then obviously in Watford, you have all the kind of LTJ Bookham, Good Looking Record stuff. You have Moving Shadow from Stevenage. It's like, there's so much amazing jungle and electronic stuff literally just surrounding us. Well,
yeah.
I think it was a different landscape, but it's amazing to, I can kind of hear the kind of Hertfordshire vibe within the music. I know that really? Sounds Yeah, there's something about it that just sounds like it's hard to describe. There's just a feeling about it. I don't know. And it's, you know, and so much of that music is so euphoric and so nostalgic. Like if I listen to some, you know, LTJ Bookham stuff now, I'm like, you know, almost brings tears to my eyes, even though I kind of, you know, I didn't really live through that period. But yeah, but anyway, so the artist that I'm going to mention is a lot closer to us. And yeah, he's a musician called Chris Clark, or he's now called Clark. But he was, to us, to me, I've always sort of seen him as like a mentor. He was like the first guy from St. Albans that we knew that signed to Warp Records, that was like the coolest label to us growing up. And he was writing this weird kind of bleepy bloopy music on his laptop, but like traveling the world and playing, you know, just his music that he'd written on his laptop was taking him around the world. And I was just like, I want to do that. I have to find a way to do that. And he was just, you know, at school we had a Logic, it was eMagic Logic Gold 5, like one of the very early versions of Logic. And I just start writing and jamming on that, and then sending him tracks, and he'd write me like page long replies saying, oh, do this, try this. And then so I ended up meeting Chris eventually. He was always playing down at the Horn, which is the local pub in St. Albans.
It's a legendary pub, right?
Yeah, legendary pub. Like, I met Bono once, and even he remembered. He was like, oh, you're from St. Albans. Yeah, we played it used to be called the Horn of Plenty before the Horn Reborn. And yeah, so, you know, yeah, it's a legendary venue. Yeah. So Chris would be playing down there, and yeah, he kind of, I guess he was just always really supportive, really inspirational. And then he's actually just put out a new record, which I should probably plug, with Tom York from Radiohead. So, you know, he's got big admirers of his music. Tom York, I think, is singing on his album. Yeah. And so it was just like, you know, he's always really sort of friendly and engaged. Like, I just was messaging him this morning, and he was like, you know, he's asking me about vocal warm-up techniques. So it's kind of cool to like have a hero that I now kind of consider like a friend,
yeah,
I guess.
That's wonderful.
And he gave us like our first sample CD, which is our first record, is basically based around these samples that he gave us. So yeah, it's got to be Chris Clark, and the track is called Rob Lee. This is going to get confusing because Rob Lee is actually the bass player of our band.
Yeah.
So Chris Clark named the song after the bass player, the one that I met in HMV. So
And I think if you search it, it's under just Clark, I believe.
It is under Clark.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Last track, and this is when you get to play Tastemaker. Ed, tell me a song that you think many people may not know that you would like them to hear, please.
So yeah, over the kind of lockdown period, I just did this just because I was bored. And also I feel like I've never been very good at like connecting with our fans. I just started doing like half an hour in the morning from 7:30 till 8, just playing music just to our mega fans, basically, and just chatting over the music so I wouldn't have any copyright issues. But the kind of the music that I couldn't really play was hip hop, because I was just chatting over, I'd be chatting over all the lyrics.
Yeah.
And, so yeah, my last choice is Big L, Freestyle 98. And this just takes me back to kind of skateboarding in St. Albans, going to the Pioneer Club. And, you know, it's just, it was a different time for hip hop. To me, it's like, when I listen to it now, I'm like, this is like jazz music.
Yeah.
It's just so lyrical. It's just really beautiful, but also really, you know, aggressive and gnarly.
Yeah.
And I guess Big L was like one of those rappers that maybe just, I guess, well, unfortunately he got shot before he was able to like really take his career to the next level, but he kind of got to dig a little bit more deeper to find his stuff. But Big L, Freestyle 98.
Just before we start to sort of wrap it up, Ed, you just touched on, I didn't realize that skateboarding was a part of your life, then tell me about how important skateboarding was, because whenever, you know, musicians reference skating and it was a big thing for me growing up, it maybe kind of before your time, for me it was skate videos was where I heard new music. That was where I heard exciting American bands was on the skateboard videos.
For me, also. It was. Totally. 100%. I was big into snowboarding and skating.
Yeah.
And where I heard Oasis Slide Away was actually on a snowboard video called Odd Man Out, which is directed by a guy called Christian Stevenson. I pronounced his name wrong. Who I now know. But it's everything. I can remember, like, I don't know if maybe this is a bit later, but for you, but like the end, Birdhouse had such an iconic soundtrack.
Yeah.
Did you ever watch that one?
No, I didn't. No.
Right. A bit too late. I don't know. So for you, was it like kind of more, what period are we talking about?
I would have been skating in probably 1991. And so, you know, I was discovering a lot of sort of like grunge stuff. Like I remember sort of hearing like Mudhoney for the first time on sort of skate videos, even sort of stuff like sort of Fishbone and them kind of the sort of offshoots of your sort of Faith No More. You hear like Mr. Bungle and things like that. It was just like, what's this? And you can Shazam it, you know, you'd have to sort of wait until someone or on the credits, it'd be like, or whatever, flag up what this track was. And it was like, that was such an important thing and fashion as well. And like, and it's so weird when you look at the biggest, most expensive brands now that people are wearing on the streets were literally, you know, what we wore then, like, which was totally affordable. And
100%.
Yeah.
I remember being like obsessed with, you know, like Etnies footwear. You know, you'd be obsessed with skate shoes.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, oh, this is like the Eric Costin Etnies or whatever. That was like a huge part of my life. I guess that for me at that time, it would have been DJ Shadow Introducing.
Oh.
That was the skate album for me and my mates.
Yeah.
Like that, and then kind of like Gravediggers and that kind of horrorcore hip hop thing. There's something about, like, I know it's slightly different for older generations, but for my generation, that kind of trip hoppy hip hop thing just goes so well with skateboarding. Yeah. I don't know why. It just feels so smooth.
Absolutely. Ed, we put together a little Spotify playlist to accompany the podcast with all of the tracks that you've spoken about today. And obviously we'll put some of your music on. And with that in mind, what's happening musically? Tell me what's coming up. What's going on?
So we're doing the kind of 15th anniversary of the first record. We're doing some shows. We might have a little surprise that we'll do at the shows. I don't know. We're still undecided. Well, actually, no, we said we are going to do it yesterday. So maybe we'll have a special surprise for, you know, the old school fans that are going to come check out the show. And we're working on stuff and it's going really nicely. And who knows, the fans might hear it sooner rather than later.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. And if people want to keep up to speed with everything you're doing, where's the best place to stay up to speed?
Probably just on our Instagram, Friendly Fire's Instagram. We're in the process of redoing our website so we can just get all of our merch and all of our stuff a bit more worldwide. I'm kind of finding that I'm just caring more about that stuff now.
Yeah.
Just like searching out screen printers. Like there's a young screen printer guy near me and it's great just being able to like care more about that stuff.
Yeah.
And then hopefully we can make it an easier process for the fans to just buy stuff straight away and we can get that rolling.
Wonderful. Well, if it's all right with you, we'll tag you and everything when this comes out, and wish you all the best with the gigs and the music. And just want to say I've had a lovely time chatting, Ed. Thank you so much, mate.
Oh, thanks so much, Stu. Cheers. And it's amazing that Now record is, you know, still got it. That's so cool. I love that. I love that, man.
I'm going to press stop. Don't go anywhere. Oh, wow. That was lovely. What a top lad. Eddie's. Just a really, really nice little natter there. I got to speak about some great records with him. And it's always nice when, and I think maybe with the exception of Teen Spirit, I think like nobody had chosen any of the records that he'd chosen today. So it's always nice to get to speak about bands like Chick 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 and things like that, because, you know, sometimes we do find that, you know, that the same songs may kind of present themselves a couple of times, and so it's always really refreshing when you get sort of thrown some tracks that you probably might not have expected to hear. And so yeah, and go and check out them tracks now over on the Spotify playlist. And if you want to watch the episode, head over to Patreon, and also over there you can get access to all the radio shows, and you get invites to the live shows. You can listen and watch the previous live shows. Yeah, other than that, just go and explore that back catalogue now, because there's 500 episodes available for free wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe. If you want to leave a comment, that's great. We're on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, so please give us a like, love, share, retweet over there. And yeah, and I will see you next time. And in the meantime, be nice to each other. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.